Chapter 8. Mastering the Mind. Introduction. Having presented a broad overview of the world transcending path in the previous chapter, in this chapter and the next, I intend to focus more specifically on two aspects of this path as described in the Nikayas: meditation and wisdom. As we have seen, the gradual training is divided into the three sections of moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. See pages 225 through 226. Moral discipline begins with the observance of precepts, which anchor one's actions in principles of conscientious behavior and moral restraint. The undertaking of precepts, for the Nikayas, particularly the full code of monastic precepts, is called the training in the higher moral discipline. Adhisila Sikha. Moral discipline, consistently observed, infuses the mind with the purifying force of moral virtue, generating joy and deeper confidence in the Dhamma. Established upon moral discipline, the disciple takes up the practice of meditation, intended to stabilize the mind and clear away the obstacles to the unfolding of wisdom. Because meditation elevates the mind beyond its normal level, this phase of practice is called the training in the higher mind, Adhisita Sikha. Because it brings inner stillness and quietude, it is also called the development of serenity, Samatha Bhavana. Successful practice results in deep concentration or mental unification, Samadhi, also known as internal serenity of mind, Ajhatam Seto Samatha. The most eminent types of concentration recognized in the Nikayas are the four jhanas, which constitute right concentration, Summa Samadhi, of the Noble Eightfold Path. Beyond the jhanas lie the four formless attainments, Arupa Samapatti, which carry the process of mental unification to still subtler levels. The third stage of practice is the training in the higher wisdom, Adhipanya Sikha, designed to awaken direct insight into the true nature of things as disclosed by the Buddha's teaching. This will be dealt with in detail in the following chapter. The first selection below, text 8.1, is a miscellany of short epigrams that stress the need for mental cultivation. The sayings occur in pairs. In each pair, the first member signals the dangers of the uncultivated mind. The second extols the benefits of the cultivated mind. The uncultivated mind is easy prey to the defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion, and their offshoots. The defilements generate unwholesome kamma, which bring painful results both in this life and in future lives. Since the defilements are the cause of our suffering and bondage, the path to liberation necessarily involves a meticulous process of mental training intended to subdue them and ultimately uproot them from their nesting place in the deep recesses of the mind. From development of the mind arise happiness, freedom, and peace. Development of the mind for the Nikayas means the development of serenity, samatha, and insight, vipassana. Text 8.2.1 says that when serenity is developed, it leads to concentration and the liberation of the mind from such emotional defilements as lust and ill will. When insight is developed, it leads to the higher wisdom of insight into the true nature of phenomena and permanently liberates the mind from ignorance. Thus, the two things most needed to master the mind are serenity and insight. Since concentration is the basis for wisdom, the Nikayas usually treat the development of serenity as the precursor to the development of insight. However, because the aptitudes of meditators differ, several suttas allow for alternative approaches to this sequence. Text 8.2.2 speaks of four approaches to mental cultivation. 1. The first approach, the classical one, is to develop serenity first and insight afterward. By serenity is meant the jhanas, or, according to the Pali commentaries, a state bordering on the jhanas called access or threshold concentration, Upakara Samadhi. 2. A second approach is to develop insight first and serenity afterward. Since there can be no real insight without concentration, such meditators, presumably people with sharp intellectual faculties, must initially use concentration as the basis for acquiring insight into the true characteristics of phenomena. However, it seems that such concentration, though sufficient for insight, is not strong enough to allow for a breakthrough to the supramundane path. These meditators must therefore return to the task of unifying the mind before resuming the work of insight. Such insight, based on concentration, culminates in the supramundane path. 3. A third approach is to develop serenity and insight in tandem. Meditators who take this approach first attain a particular level of concentration, such as a jhana or formless attainment, and then employ it as a basis for insight. Having developed insight, they then return to concentration, attain a different jhana or formless attainment, and use that as a basis for insight. Thus, they proceed until they reach the supramundane path. 4. The description of the fourth approach is somewhat obscure. The sutta says that a monk's mind is seized by agitation about the teachings, and then, sometime later, he gains concentration and attains the supramundane path. This statement suggests a person initially driven by such intense desire to understand the Dhamma that he or she cannot focus clearly upon any meditation object. Later, with the aid of certain supporting conditions, this person manages to subdue the mind, gain concentration, and attain the supramundane path. Text 8.2.3 again confirms that both serenity and insight are necessary, and also indicates the skills needed for their respective practice. The cultivation of serenity requires skill in steadying, composing, unifying, and concentrating the mind. The cultivation of insight requires skill in observing, investigating, and discerning conditioned phenomena, spoken of as formations, sankhara. In line with the preceding text, this sutta confirms that some meditators begin by developing internal serenity of mind, others by developing the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, others by developing both in tandem. But while meditators may start off differently, eventually they must all strike a healthy balance between serenity and insight. The exact point of balance between the two will differ from one person to another. But when a meditator achieves the appropriate balance, serenity and insight join forces to issue in the knowledge and vision of the Four Noble Truths. This knowledge and vision, the world transcending wisdom, occurs in four distinct installments, the four stages of realization which, in sequence, permanently destroy ignorance along with the affiliated defilements. Text 8.2.2 subsumes these defilements under the expression the fetters and underlying tendencies. The main impediments to the development of serenity and insight are collectively called the five hindrances, which we already met in the extended account of the gradual training. See text 7, 4, stanza 18. Text 8.3 states that just as different impurities of water prevent us from clearly seeing the reflection of our face in a bowl of water, so the five hindrances prevent us from properly understanding our own good and the good of others. A meditator's initial efforts, therefore, have to be devoted to the task of overcoming the hindrances. Once these are overcome, success is assured in the practice of serenity and insight. Text 8.4 compares the successive stages in the purification of the mind to the refinement of gold. The meditating monk begins by removing the gross impurities of bodily, verbal, and mental conduct. This is achieved by moral discipline and vigilant introspection. Then he eliminates the middle-level impurities of unwholesome thoughts, thoughts of sensuality, ill will, and harmfulness. Next come the subtle impurities of meandering thoughts. Finally, he must eliminate thoughts about the Dhamma, the subtlest obstacle. When all such distracting thoughts are removed, the monk attains mental unification, ekobidhava. The the basis for the six direct knowledges, abhinya, culminating in arahantship, the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. The Nikayas sometimes compare the process of training the mind to the taming of a wild animal. Just as an animal trainer has to use various techniques to bring the animal under control, the meditator has to draw upon various methods to subdue the mind. It is not enough to be acquainted with one meditation technique. One must be skilled in a number of methods intended as antidotes to specific mental obstructions. In text 8.5, the Buddha explains five ancillary techniques, here called signs, nimitta, that a monk might deploy to eliminate unwholesome thoughts connected with lust, hatred, and delusion. One who succeeds in overcoming distracting thoughts by the use of these techniques is called a master of the courses of thought. The suttas teach various techniques of meditation aimed at inducing concentration. One popular formula pits specific meditation subjects against the unwholesome mental states they are intended to rectify. Thus, the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body, see text 8, 8, stanza 10, is the remedy for sensual lust. Loving kindness is the remedy for ill will. Mindfulness of breathing is the remedy for restlessness, and the perception of impermanence is the remedy for the conceit, I am. The perception of impermanence is a subject of insight meditation, the other three subjects of serenity meditation. Loving kindness is the first of the four divine abodes, Brahma Vihara, or immeasurable states, Apamanya, briefly described in chapter 5. Boundless loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. These are respectively the antidotes to ill will, harmfulness, discontent, and partiality. Since we already introduced the standard canonical passage on the divine abodes in connection with meditation as a basis for merit, see text 5.5.2, to shed a different spotlight on this practice, I have included here as text 8.6, the famous simile of the saw, a passage that shows loving kindness in action. Through the centuries, the most popular meditation subjects among lay Buddhists have probably been the six recollections, anusati, of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, morality, generosity, and the Devas. Text 8.7 is an important canonical source for these meditations. Their themes are especially close to the hearts and everyday experiences of people living household lives in a culture imbued with Buddhist values. These meditation practices in turn enrich and uplift their lives, bringing them into closer spiritual contact with the ideals of religious faith. The first three are primarily devotional recollections that build upon confidence in the three jewels, but while they begin with faith, they temporarily cleanse the mind of defilements and conduce to sustained concentration. The meditation on moral discipline develops from one's observance of the precepts, a practice aimed at self-benefit. The recollection of generosity builds upon one's practice of giving, an altruistic practice. The recollection of the devas is a contemplation of the fruits of one's faith, morality, generosity, and wisdom as they mature in future lives. The discourse generally considered to offer the most comprehensive instructions on meditation practice is the Satipatthana Sutta. Two versions of this sutta exist, a longer version in the Dikha Nikaya, a middle-length version in the Majjhima Nikaya. The former differs from the latter only by its extended analysis of the Four Noble Truths, which may have originally been an early commentary incorporated into the discourse. The middle-length version is included here as text 8.8, an entire chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya. The Satipatthana Samyutta is also devoted to this system of meditation. The Satipatthana Sutta does not recommend a single meditation subject, nor even a single method of meditation. Its purpose, rather, is to explain how to establish the mode of contemplation needed to arrive at realization of Nibbana. The appropriate frame of mind to be established, as implied by the title of the sutta, is called an establishment of mindfulness. The word satipatthana should probably be understood as a compound of sati, mindfulness, and upatthana, establishment. Hence, establishment of mindfulness would be the rendering that best captures the original meaning. According to the standard formula that accompanies each exercise, asatipatthana is a mode of dwelling, viharati. This mode of dwelling involves observation of objects in the proper frame of mind. The frame of mind consists of three positive qualities: energy, atapa, ardor, mindfulness, sati, and clear comprehension, sampajanya. The word sati originally meant memory, but in the present context it signifies recollection of the present, a sustained awareness of what is happening to us and within us on each occasion of experience. Mindfulness, in its initial stages, is concerned with keeping the contemplative mind continually on its object, which means keeping the object continually present to the mind. Mindfulness prevents the mind from slipping away, from drifting off under the sway of random thoughts into mental proliferation and forgetfulness. Mindfulness is often said to occur in close conjunction with clear comprehension, a clear knowledge and understanding of what one is experiencing. The opening formula of the sutta says that one engages in this practice after having subdued longing and dejection in regard to the world. Vineya loke abhijha domanasam. The expression having subdued need not be taken to imply that one must first overcome longing and dejection, which, according to the commentary, signify greed and aversion, and thus represent the five hindrances, before one can start to practice satipatthana. The expression might be understood to mean that the practice is itself the means of overcoming longing and dejection. Thus, while subduing the obstructive influences of greed and aversion, the meditator arouses the positive qualities of energy, mindfulness, and clear comprehension, and contemplates four objective domains: the body, feelings, states of mind, and phenomena. It is these four objective domains that differentiate mindful observation into four establishments of mindfulness. The four objective domains divide the expository portion of the Satipatthana Sutta into four major sections. Two of these sections, the first and the fourth, have several subdivisions. When the divisions are added up, we obtain altogether 21 meditation subjects. Several of these can be used as means to develop serenity, samatha. But the Satipatthana system as a whole seems especially designed for the development of insight. The main sections with their divisions are as follows. 1. Contemplation of the body, kayanupassana. This comprises 14 subjects of meditation: mindfulness of breathing, contemplation of the four postures, clear comprehension of activities, attention to the unattractive nature of the body, viewed by way of its organs and tissues, attention to the elements, and 9 charnel ground contemplations. Contemplations based on corpses in different stages of decomposition. 2. Contemplation of feeling, vedananupassana. Feeling is differentiated into 3 primary types: pleasant, painful, and neither painful nor pleasant, which are each further distinguished into carnal and spiritual feelings. However, because these are all merely different types of feeling, the contemplation of feeling is considered one subject. 3. Contemplation of mind, cittanupassana. This is one subject of contemplation, the mind, differentiated into 8 pairs of contrasting states of mind. Contemplation of phenomena, dhammanupassana. The word dhamma here probably signifies phenomena, which are classified into 5 categories governed by the Buddha's teachings. The dhamma, thus, dhammanupassana, has a dual meaning: dhammas, phenomena, contemplated by way of the dhamma, the teaching. The 5 categories are the 5 hindrances, the 5 aggregates, the 6 internal and external sense bases, the 7 factors of enlightenment, and the 4 noble truths. Although not specified in the sutta, a progressive sequence seems to be implied by the terms of describing each contemplation. In mindfulness of breathing, one moves to subtler levels of quiescence. In contemplation of feeling, one moves toward non-carnal feelings that are neither painful nor pleasant. In contemplation of mind, one moves toward states of mind that are concentrated and liberated. These all suggest that progressive contemplation brings enhanced concentration. In the contemplation of phenomena, the emphasis shifts toward insight. One begins by observing and overcoming the five hindrances. The overcoming of the hindrances marks success in concentration. With the concentrated mind, one contemplates the five aggregates and the six sense bases. As contemplation gains momentum, the seven factors of enlightenment become manifest, and the development of the seven enlightenment factors culminates in knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. Knowledge of the Four Noble Truths liberates the mind from the defilements and thus leads to the attainment of Nibbana. Thus, this system of meditation fulfills the potential ascribed to it by the Buddha of leading directly to the realization of Nibbana. Each major contemplative exercise is supplemented by an auxiliary section, a refrain with four subdivisions. The first states that the meditator contemplates the object internally, within his or her own experience, externally, reflectively considering it as occurring within the experience of others, and both. This ensures that one obtains a comprehensive and balanced view of the object. The second portion states that the meditator contemplates the object as subject to origination, as subject to vanishing, and as subject to both origination and vanishing. This brings to light the characteristic of impermanence and thus leads to insight into the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, and non-self, anicca, dukkha, anatta. The third states that the meditator is simply aware of the bare object to the extent necessary for constant mindfulness and knowledge. And the fourth describes the meditator as dwelling in a state of complete detachment, not clinging to anything in the world. In the Satipatthana Sutta, mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, is included as merely one meditation subject among others. But the Nikayas assign it a position of fundamental importance. The Buddha said that he used mindfulness of breathing as his main meditation subject for the attainment of enlightenment. See Samyutta Nikaya 54.8.5.3.17. During his teaching career, he occasionally went into seclusion to devote himself to the concentration gained through mindfulness of breathing. And he confers on it a unique honor by calling it the Tathagata's dwelling. Samyutta Nikaya 54.11.5.3.26. Mindfulness of breathing is the subject of an entire chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya 54. Anapana Samyutta. Whereas the Satipatthana Sutta explains mindfulness of breathing by a four-step formula, the suttas in this collection expand its practice to 16 steps. Text 8-9 from the Anapana Samyutta describes the 16 steps. Since these steps are not necessarily sequential but partly overlap, they might be thought of as facets rather than actual steps. The 16 facets are grouped into four tetrads, each of which corresponds to one of the four establishments of mindfulness. The first tetrad contains the four facets mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta in its section on contemplation of the body. But the other tetrads extend the practice to the contemplations of feelings, mind, and phenomena. Thus, the development of mindfulness of breathing can fulfill not just one, but all four establishments of mindfulness. The four establishments of mindfulness, based on mindfulness of breathing, in turn, fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment, and these in turn fulfill true knowledge and liberation. This exposition thus shows mindfulness of breathing to be a complete subject of meditation that begins with simple attention to the breath and culminates in the permanent liberation of the mind. Finally, in text 8.10, the Buddha's chief disciple, the Venerable Sariputta, testifies to his own achievement of mastery over the mind. In reply to questions from the Venerable Ananda, he explains how he is able to dwell for a whole day in each of the jhanas and formless attainments, as well as in the special attainment called the cessation of perception and feeling. Sannyavidayi Tanirodha. In each case, because he is an arahant, He can do so without grasping these attainments with thoughts of I and mine. Chapter 8. Mastering the Mind. Part 1. The mind is the key. 1. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that is so unwieldy as an undeveloped mind. An undeveloped mind is truly unwieldy. 2. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that is so wieldy as a developed mind. A developed mind is truly wieldy. 3. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that leads to such great harm as an undeveloped mind. An undeveloped mind leads to great harm. 4. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that leads to such great benefit as a developed mind. A developed mind leads to great benefit. 9. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that when undeveloped and uncultivated entails such great suffering as the mind. The mind, when undeveloped and uncultivated, entails great suffering. 10. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that when developed and cultivated entails such great happiness as the mind. The mind, when developed and cultivated, entails great happiness. Anguttara Nikaya 1. 3. 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, 10. 1, 5 through 6. Part 2. Developing a pair of skills. Verse 1. Serenity and insight. Two things, O monks, partake of true knowledge. What two? Serenity and insight. When serenity is developed, what benefit does one experience? The mind is developed. When the mind is developed, what benefit does one experience? All lust is abandoned. When insight is developed, what benefit does one experience? Wisdom is developed. When wisdom is developed, what benefit does one experience? All ignorance is abandoned. A mind defiled by lust is not liberated, and wisdom defiled by ignorance is not developed. Thus, monks, through the fading away of lust there is liberation of the mind, and through the fading away of ignorance there is liberation by wisdom. Anguttara Nikaya 2. 3. 10. 1. 61. Verse 2. Four ways to arahantship. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Venerable Ananda was dwelling at Kosambi in Gosita's monastery. There the Venerable Ananda addressed the monks thus. Friends. Yes, friend, the monks replied. Thereupon the Venerable Ananda said, Friends, whatever monks or nuns declare before me that they have attained the final knowledge of arahantship, all these do so in one of four ways. What for? Here, friends, a monk develops insight preceded by serenity. While he thus develops insight preceded by serenity, the path arises in him. He now pursues, develops, and cultivates that path. And while he is doing so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies eliminated. Or again, friends, a monk develops serenity preceded by insight. While he thus develops serenity preceded by insight, the path arises in him. He now pursues, develops, and cultivates that path. And while he is doing so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies eliminated. Or again, friends, a monk develops serenity and insight joined in pairs. While he thus develops serenity and insight joined in pairs, the path arises in him. He now pursues, develops, and cultivates that path. And while he is doing so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies eliminated. Or again, friends, a monk's mind is seized by agitation about the teaching. But there comes a time when his mind becomes internally steadied, composed, unified, and concentrated. Then the path arises in him. He now pursues, develops, and cultivates that path. And while he is doing so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies eliminated. Friends, whatever monks or nuns declare before me that they have attained the final knowledge of arahantship, all these do so in one of these four ways. Anguttara Nikaya 4.170, 2.156 through 157. Verse 3. Four kinds of persons. These four kinds of persons, O monks, are found existing in the world. What for? Here, monks, a certain person gains internal serenity of mind, but does not gain the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Another person gains the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, but does not gain internal serenity of mind. Another person gains neither internal serenity of mind nor the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, and another person gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Therein, monks, the person who gains internal serenity of mind, but not the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, should approach one who gains the higher wisdom and inquire of him, "How, friend, should formations be seen? How should formations be explored? How should formations be discerned with insight?" The other then answers him, as he has seen and understood the matter thus, "Formations should be seen in such a way. They should be explored in such a way. They should be discerned with insight in such a way." At a later time, this one gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Therein, monks, the person who gains the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena but not internal serenity of mind should approach one who gains internal serenity and inquire of him, "How, friend, should the mind be steadied? How should the mind be composed? How should the mind be unified? How should the mind be concentrated?" The other then answers him, as he has seen and understood the matter thus, "The mind should be steadied in such a way, composed in such a way, unified in such a way, concentrated in such a way." At a later time, this one gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Therein, monks, the person who gains neither internal serenity of mind nor the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena should approach one who gains both and inquire of him, "How, friend, should the mind be steadied? How, friend, should formations be seen?" The other then answers him, as he has seen and understood the matter thus, "The mind should be steadied in such a way. Formations should be seen in such a way." At a later time, this one gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Therein, monks, the person who gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena should establish himself in just these wholesome states and make a further effort for the destruction of the taints. Anguttara Nikaya 4.94 2. 93-95 Part 3. The Hindrances to Mental Development. Then the Brahmin Sangarava approached the Blessed One, exchanged greetings with him, sat down to one side and said, "Master Gotama, why is it that sometimes even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited? And why is it that sometimes those texts that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited?" Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sensual lust, overwhelmed by sensual lust, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen sensual lust, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water mixed with red, yellow, blue, or crimson dye. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sensual lust, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by ill will, overwhelmed by ill will, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen ill will, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water being heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by ill will, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by dullness and drowsiness, one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen dullness and drowsiness. On that occasion, one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water covered over with water plants and algae. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by dullness and drowsiness, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, overwhelmed by restlessness and remorse, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen restlessness and remorse, on that occasion, one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, turned into wavelets. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by doubt, overwhelmed by doubt, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen doubt, on that occasion, one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, placed in the dark. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by doubt, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. This, Brahman, is the reason why even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Brahman, when one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by sensual lust, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, on that occasion, even those texts that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water that is not mixed with dyes, not bubbling and boiling, not covered over with water plants and algae, not stirred by the wind and churned into wavelets, clear, serene, limpid, set out in the light. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would know and see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by sensual lust, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, on that occasion, even those texts that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. This, Brahman, is the reason why even those texts that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. When this was said, the Brahmin Sangarava said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, Let Master Gotama accept me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge from today until life's end. Samyutta Nikaya 46-55, abridged. 5:121-126. Part 4. The Refinement of the Mind. There are, O monks, gross impurities in gold, such as earth and sand, gravel and grit. Now the goldsmith or his apprentice first pours the gold into a trough and washes, rinses, and cleans it thoroughly. When he has done this, there still remains moderate impurities in the gold, such as fine grit and coarse sand. Then the goldsmith or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When he has done this, there still remain minute impurities in the gold, such as fine sand and black dust. Now the goldsmith or his apprentice repeats the washing, and thereafter only the gold dust remains. He now pours the gold into a melting pot, smelts it, and melts it together, but he does not yet take it out from the vessel, as the dross has not yet been entirely removed and the gold is not yet quite pliant, workable, and bright. It is still brittle and does not yet lend itself easily to molding. But a time comes when the goldsmith or his apprentice repeats the melting thoroughly so that the flaws are entirely removed. The gold is now quite pliant, workable, and bright, and it lends itself easily to molding. Whatever ornament the goldsmith now wishes to make of it, be it a diadem, earrings, a necklace, or a golden chain, the gold can now be used for that purpose. It is similar, monks, with a monk devoted to the training in the higher mind. There are in him gross impurities, namely bad conduct of body, speech, and mind. Such conduct an earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, eliminates, and abolishes. When he has abandoned these, there are still impurities of a moderate degree that cling to him, namely sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. Such thoughts an earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, eliminates, and abolishes. When he has abandoned these, there are still some subtle impurities that cling to him, namely thoughts about his relatives, his home country, and his reputation. Such thoughts an earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, eliminates, and abolishes. When he has abandoned these, there still remain thoughts about the teaching. That concentration is not yet peaceful and sublime. It has not attained to full tranquility, nor has it achieved mental unification. It is maintained by strenuous suppression of the defilements. But there comes a time when his mind becomes inwardly steadied, composed, unified, and concentrated. That concentration is then calm and refined. It has attained to full tranquility and achieved mental unification. It is not maintained by strenuous suppression of the defilements. Then, to whatever mental state realizable by direct knowledge he directs his mind, he achieves the capacity of realizing that state by direct knowledge, whenever the necessary conditions obtain. If he wishes, may I wield the various kinds of spiritual power. Having been one, may I become many. Having been many, may I become one. May I appear and vanish, go unhindered through a wall, through a rampart, through a mountain as if through space, dive in and out of the earth as if it were water, walk on water without sinking as if it were earth, travel through the sky like a bird while seated cross-legged, touch and stroke with my hand the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty, exercise mastery with my body, even as far as the Brahma world. He achieves the capacity of realizing that state by direct knowledge whenever the necessary conditions obtain. If he wishes, with the divine ear element which is purified and surpasses the human, may I hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and human, those that are far as well as near. He achieves the capacity of realizing that state by direct knowledge whenever the necessary conditions obtain. If he wishes, may I understand the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with my own mind. May I understand a mind with lust as a mind with lust, a mind without lust as a mind without lust, a mind with hatred as a mind with hatred, a mind without hatred as a mind without hatred, a mind with delusion as a mind with delusion, a mind without delusion as a mind without delusion, a contracted mind as contracted, and a distracted mind as distracted, an exalted mind as exalted, and an unexalted mind as unexalted, a surpassable mind as surpassable, and an unsurpassable mind as unsurpassable, a concentrated mind as concentrated, and an unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated, a liberated mind as liberated, and an unliberated mind as unliberated. He achieves the capacity of realizing that state by direct knowledge, whenever the necessary conditions obtain. If he wishes, may I recollect my manifold past lives. See text 2, 3, 2, stanza 38. With their modes and details, he achieves the capacity of realizing that state by direct knowledge, whenever the necessary conditions obtain. If he wishes, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, may I see beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. See text 2, 3, 2, stanza 40. And understand how beings fare on in accordance with their action. He achieves the capacity of realizing that state by direct knowledge, whenever the necessary conditions obtain. If he wishes, by the destruction of the taints, may I in this very life enter and dwell in the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, realizing it for myself with direct knowledge, he achieves the capacity of realizing that state by direct knowledge, whenever the necessary conditions obtain. Anguttara Nikaya 3, 100, stanzas 1 through 10, 1, 253 through 256. Part 5. The Removal of Distracting Thoughts. 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi, in Jeta's Grove, Anatha Pindika's Park. There he addressed the monks thus, "Monks, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Monks, when a monk is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to 5 signs. What are the 5? 3. 1. Here, monks, when a monk is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too, when a monk gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. 4. 2. If, while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, and he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome, reprehensible, resulting in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck. So too, when a monk examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. 5.3. While he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion. Then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too, when a monk tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. 6.4. If while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, then he should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? Then he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a monk gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. 7.5. If, while he is giving attention to stilling the thought formation of these thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. When, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, a monk beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. 8. Monks, when a monk is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion, then when he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside, and with their abandoning his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. When he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. When with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, Any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside, and with their abandoning, his mind becomes steadied internally, composed, unified, and concentrated. This monk is then called a master of the courses of thought. He will think whatever thought he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, has made an end of suffering. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Majjhima Nikaya 20. Vitakkasantana Sutta 1, 118 through 122. Part 6. The Mind of Loving Kindness. 11. Monks, there are these five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or in a mood of hate. When others address you, their speech may be timely or untimely. When others address you, their speech may be true or untrue. When others address you, their speech may be gentle or harsh. When others address you, their speech may be connected with good or with harm. When others address you, their speech may be spoken with a mind of loving kindness or in a mood of hate. Herein, monks, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no bitter words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, never in a mood of hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with that person, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. That is how you should train, monks. 20. Monks, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate toward them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no bitter words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, never in a mood of hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train, monks.